All right, so backstage again at Puerto Rico Fest 2019, again with Peter Wiemersheimer. And this time, following what I've always feel is some of the best parts, if not the best parts of any conference, is the faculty dinners and the hanging out and getting all these bits and pieces of awesome pearls from awesome people. And one of the things we were talking about yesterday as we feasted on some good Puerto Rican food was regional blocks. So as, you know, predominantly an ICU guy, I really don't do any regional blocks. I think I had historically done a couple of those intercostal blocks with one of the thoracic surgeons a decade ago for broken ribs. So I was remembering that one of my practical problems in the ICU is exactly that, is a patient comes in with, you know, a decent chest injury, they've got broken ribs, they've got, you know, maybe some contused lung, and they're in the unit, usually not intubated or hoping not to, and pain control's an issue. And I think that could be an interesting thing for ICU guys to be able to do is control the pain from broken ribs and be able to help the general respiratory status. So, Peter, do you have an easy answer? Because I am completely useless at regional nerve blocks and all that rigmarole.
Well, I think regional nerve blocks are relatively straightforward to perform, and they really, if you're used to using ultrasound to place central access to do procedures, it's similarly another procedure where you're doing ultrasound needle guidance, but this time you're guiding the needle towards a nerve, and the idea is that when you put anesthetic by the nerve, you're causing the pain, the patient to have no pain in the region that is affected. So, for instance, as you're talking about patients who come with a chest wall injury, there's a really nice block called an ESP block, which...
And that stands for?
Erector spinae...
All right.
Let's edit that one out. It's erector spinae block, erector spinae plane block. And the idea is that you can take a large amount of anesthetic and place it really by one of the transverse processes, and you can anesthetize essentially the hemithorax. And so for some of the elderly patients that we see who have rib fractures, there's a couple issues that happen with injury for patients who will be in the ICU. The first, elderly patients don't tolerate opiates well,
right.
So it's multimodal analgesia, but oftentimes relatively ineffective, and you're trying to have a patient not splint and expand their lungs, not require intubation. That's difficult to do when it's painful to take an inspiratory breath. So doing an ESP block really buys you, 6 hours or more of pain-free inspiration. And so the concept of pain for me is what's really fascinating is that there's recruitment. And I think initially after a traumatic injury, there's emotional and physical pain, there's a recruitment of pain receptors, and it's hard to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found in the emergency department with patients who have chest wall injuries that are when I've done an ESP block, then I have a period of time to start adding on multimodal analgesia. I have time to actually talk to my patient about what to expect when the anesthetic wears off. And they can also start using a paradigm of inflating their lungs and getting good respiratory effort. And then as the anesthetic wears off, they do better. They have less need for analgesia, and they have better respiratory functions. So it seems like a really nice paradigm for managing these patients.
Nice. And on a practical level, how do you do it? In a few words.
Really a very straightforward nerve block. We're taking I use a nerve block needle because they're a little more hyperechoic, and as I teach it, it's easier to have confidence in the right spot. But you're essentially taking a nerve block needle or any needle and finding I use L5, so the transverse process of T5, excuse me, and just place a needle right by T5 and inject 30 cc's of ropivacaine or bupivacaine, whatever long-acting anesthetic you have. And that works great. So it's really not difficult. It's almost really considered an entry-level block in terms of ease of application.
That sounds really good to me. So I'm not even aiming for a particular nerve in this case.
You're aiming at a bone, and right above the bone, you're instilling a bunch of fluid, and it takes effect without you doing anything more specific than that.
So I will have to review posterior anatomy a little bit, because not having much need for it, it's mostly gone. But that sounds really good. So I will review that and look at that. And anything else you can think of in terms of the kind of patients we usually get up in the unit that would have a lot of pain that could be useful to block?
Well, I'm thinking of, there's two blocks that I think of with patients that go to unit. First is there are a lot of elderly patients who have falls and injury and have hip fractures, long bone lower extremity fractures.
Especially in Vermont and Quebec.
Absolutely. Thank God for ICE. It's job security, right? So, you know, another relatively entry-level block that's easy to do without putting a needle near a target is a fascia iliaca nerve block. And what's nice about this, you can, again, do a high volume of anesthetic or even anesthetic with saline mixed in to get a higher volume and cause a hip fracture pain to essentially go away or almost be completely insensate. And again, these are patients who are often have really difficult time with pain control, not tolerating opiates, not tolerating any other ways of controlling pain without getting hypotensive or altered. And so by placing a block, again, minimizes the amount of opiate analgesia I need to use, and I can resuscitate, and also counsel the patient in terms of how to handle an injury. Like these injuries in elderly patients are often, they can be end of life, they have a high morbidity. And so in addition to the pain from the fracture itself, I think a lot of these patients come in really devastated by the injury and how that's gonna affect their life. So having the time for a patient to be pain-free buys them time in terms of getting true analgesia on board, but also to do some emotional coping and work on how life is going to go on going forward.
And that is really important to actually be able to, you know, have the discussion with the patient, especially for the levels of care discussion. Someone who's going into the OR possibly and who can be very elderly, and as we know, high mortality associated with the hip fractures.
Right. Yeah, and you know, I've had the experience of having patients who are just literally in tears. And once their pain is controlled, they calm down, recoup, and seem to do much better. And there's actually a couple of nice papers about even return to function and length of hospital and ICU stay just based on using fascia iliaca blocks that are really effective.
All right, so EPS block and fascia iliaca block. And the fascia iliaca block, I presume, is somewhere in the femoral area?
Yep. Again, you know, it's a relatively straightforward entry-level block. You're going in the fascia of the iliacus muscle, so you're lateral to neurovascular structures and literally watching a needle penetrate the fascia and injecting a high volume of fluid below muscle fascia. So very safe, and I think cognitively something that's easy to learn and do without a lot of anxiety about going too close to a nerve or a vascular structure.
Awesome. And what agent do you use?
We use ropivacaine. It's a long-acting agent similar to bupivacaine, considered to be a little less cardiotoxic. The reality is that for these blocks, especially with ultrasound guidance, you're not going near a vessel.
Right.
So I think providers should be comfortable with whatever they have in their hospital to use and feel confident that they have a very low chance of causing any outward effects from the block itself.
All right, awesome. Well, I'm gonna be looking for the next set of broken ribs to try this out on after I brush up on this a little bit.
So I have a question for you.
Oh.
Do you ever do ultrasound-guided IJ access in the neck?
Very rarely. Very rarely. I usually do spotted, so I'll make sure that I don't have a funny, you know, and sometimes if you look at enough, sometimes you have a huge IJ on one side and a tiny one on the other, or one that's retro-carotid or something like that. But once I've seen, for the most part, my IJs, I mostly do blind. It's just a matter of blind is generally a 1 minute procedure, and you know, guided with getting the sheath and everything on becomes a 5 minute procedure, and I am old school like that. So my IJs by and large remain blind, unless if I have someone who's very hypovolemic and or, you know, has got no platelets or any number of other reasons, or it's really, you know, really close to the carotid and I can't confidently feel it when I put fingers of my either left or right hand, depending which side I'm going, and knowing where my carotid is, then I might use it. But it's a minority of cases.
Well, the reason I ask is, since we were talking about nerve blocks, you know, typically, in my experience, if I use an ultrasound to assess even the patency of the IJ or whether I can actually pass a catheter into the IJ or not, that's an excellent opportunity to do a superficial cervical plexus block.
Aha.
And that block is placed mid-neck. We used to do it blind, but ultrasound makes it just a little more reliable. And the idea is you can look at your IJ, look at your neck anatomy, just confirm that you have a patent vessel to cannulize, and then take a syringe of lidocaine and with the ultrasound guidance, just inject some lidocaine right by the superficial cervical plexus, and that'll cause the entire neck to be anesthetized. So now when you go back and place your IJ, your patient feels no pain when you put the catheter in, when you dilate, or when you do any of your procedure, because the neck has become insensate at that point.
So you're going to force me to go back to some anatomy books and find, because you mentioned casually that, oh, just drop it by the superficial cervical plexus, which I have no idea where it is.
It's basically going lateral to the sternocleidomastoid, or posterior lateral, and just underneath the sternocleidomastoid, and placing a spot of anesthetic. And literally, you don't see the nerve, you just know the anatomical region you're placing the needle. And I usually do 5 or 10 cc's, usually for me 10 cc's, because I'm somewhat klutzy. But that works great, and then I have a patient whose neck is insensate. I can prep, I can cannulate, and they feel nothing at all.
That is pretty awesome. That is pretty awesome, especially for your mildly agitated, non-intubated, non-sedated patient. That could be very useful.
I think maybe we should all go through the experience of having a drape put over our face and having somebody talk to us while we're covered up and somebody's holding the drape so we can breathe. It's not exactly a very relaxing situation.
Well, those are the patients I often actually go for subclavians.
Yep.
Just because it's a little less oppressive, I think, when you're conscious.
Absolutely.
You know, the shoulder versus the neck.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so time to brush up on a little bit of anatomy, review the procedures for a couple of blocks, but I'm definitely going to be trying that. I think it's an important skill that we should be going for if we're managing patients with broken ribs and a lot of pain, especially. All right, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thank you. It's great to see you.